And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. Well, in Massachusetts, the legislative volleyball between the governor's office and the legislature has gone back and forth several times now. The most recent iteration is that the legislature has sent the next generation climate bill for the third time to Governor Baker's desk for his signature. We hope that the governor signs it and then we'll be done. But the Next Generation Climate Bill is a very forward-looking bill. It's a good thing. It puts Massachusetts back in a leadership position. And there are many perspectives, many different things inside that Next Generation Climate Roadmap Bill. And some of them particularly pertain to MCAN in terms of the building codes and the sort of work that MCAN has been doing. For that reason, we are delighted to be joined today by Rebecca Winteridge Knox, who is the Better Building Campaign Director at MCAN. How are you doing, Rebecca?
Doing well.
Good, yeah, good, nice good. To be here. And we are also joined by Sarah Dooling, who is the Executive Director of MCAN. And there you go. So tell me, you two guys, did I describe this new bill properly? What's the what are the implications of the Next Generation Roadmap bill for the work that MCAN has been doing?
Well, it's really great to be here, Ted, and it's really great to be here with Rebecca. And I just want to say, with S9 sitting on the governor's desk yet again for a third time, MCAN is really, really grateful for all of our advocates in getting this bill once again ready for his signature. And I think one of the biggest victories that this bill has in it is really codifying what it means to be an environmental justice community. And that is so important. That directs money and resources. It will allow for projects to be evaluated in more rigorous participatory ways. And so it really strengthens how these communities can become healthier and more supported by the state.
The quick question, so environmental justice is sort of this qualitative term that gets used, right? What you're saying is this bill has specific language. Can you describe what the language refers to? I mean, so when you say an environmental justice community, that's a concrete thing that means?
That means that people living together have, they are isolated by language, they are defined by racial characteristics, brown and black or indigenous populations, they have that they have historically been exposed to and now experience chronic health problems. And so the bill's language, the amendments that came out and are from the governor, actually strengthened the EJ criteria. And one of the ways that the Baker administration strengthened the EJ criteria was to actually include the impacts of climate change into how we define an environmental burden. So another way in which these EJ communities are designated and identified is that they have suffered from these environmental burdens, air pollution, and now this very broad umbrella of climate change as a specific kind of environmental burden. Urban heat island effect is one of the key ways in which you can translate this idea of climate change as an environmental burden.
It's a quantifiable thing that allows you to say, okay, in that quantification allows you to be more specific about taking action, right? It's like first you define the issue and then you're able to act on it, which is a good thing, right? So that's excellent. Okay.
Yeah. That's really, really important because now, I mean, we fund what we can measure, right? And if we can measure if we can measure health risk and health impacts from polluting facilities, from urban heat island, heat stress is very easy to measure. All of that really I think reflects an overwhelming commitment in both chambers to really centering environmental justice as part of the climate movement. And that's really, really great.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And how does that impact MCAN's work? What's the connection to what MCAN's doing?
Well, a lot of our work, as you know, includes focusing on being able to transform the building industry so that we can build. We already know how to build net zero, but how can we ensure that it becomes the new standard, right? It becomes the new base code. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that particular item was stripped out in the Baker Amendment so that the net zero stretch code, as it was originally written into the climate bill, would become the new base code by 2028. That was taken out by the Baker administration. And so that's a little bit of a worry, and that kind of highlights how MCAN will be working in the future. But the key piece is that now suddenly the Baker administration, obviously the real estate and development lobby groups, and the design and construction fields. We all know that a statewide building code is a very powerful tool to affect change. And so the question becomes, how can we make sure that the rolling out of a net zero building code, right, really benefits the environmental justice folks first and foremost? Because if we think about it, folks that live in homes that are really leaky, that are very expensive, therefore, to heat and cool, that are still relying on gas or propane or some kind of combustion-based appliances for cooking, all of those issues make it really clear that when we think about who benefits from a building that is fully electrified, that has renewables as part of what it consumes, as well as potentially produces, and that is really, really efficient, very tight building envelope with efficient kinds of infrastructure, air source heat pumps, things like that, mm-hmm. that it's the really poor housing that will benefit from being retrofitted. I want to be clear, though, the net zero stretch code, as it's written in the climate bill right now, is all for new construction. So we want to make sure that all of the buildings going forward, especially in environmental justice communities, especially in those communities that are near multiple highways, that are sort of these air pollution hotspots around the Commonwealth, mm-hmm. that how they build and how we build in more affluent communities as well ensures that all of us in the Commonwealth have safe indoor air, right? That have houses that are easy to heat and cool, affordable for our budgets, and that are producing and consuming renewable clean energy. Because a definition of a net zero building, it kind of has three piers to the foundation.
Okay. I want to hear those three peers.
Exactly. The electricity, it has to be fully electric. And so that electricity ideally will it be derived from clean energy sources. Secondly.
And just when you say fully electric, that means no gas stove. You don't need it. You would use induction heating. You would not have a gas heater in your basement. You would be using a heat pump, and you would not have a gas dryer for your clothes, right? Those, right. I think, are the major consumers, right? Or yes. Hot water heater. You wouldn't have a gas hot water heater, right? That would all be electrified.
No, right. We'd all be electrified.
And then the question of the cleanliness of the electricity is dealt with in another way, right? You're getting sort of the end use to be accepting of clean energy.
Yes, right. Yes. So you have homes and commercial buildings that are fully electric, that are super duper efficient. And that efficiency is really about tightening the building envelope. So lots of different kinds of, you know, high R value insulation in the walls, in the roof is super critical, as well as a really good filtration system. Because if you really tighten up a space, you don't want it so tight that you just kind of feel like the air is too still. Mm-hmm. So there has to be a sufficient filtration and ventilation systems. So all of that has to be in place. And that makes the, so you don't, what you don't want are people saying, we need a high efficiency, high performance, high efficiency building code. And that has the potential to be a super tight building powered by gas. Mm. So that's what you don't want. So you want three piers. So you want the electrification, you want the efficiency, and then you want the ability to generate or at least procure renewables offsite. So a net zero building, it generates, it consumes, it generates energy based on renewable sources to offset the amount of energy it consumes from non-renewable sources.
And then that just to be clear, the net portion of it, I mean, so the a true net zero building would have solar panels on the roof or would have some kind of long-term contract to buy the electricity from, and is that, is it in the building code to buy electricity 20 years from now? I mean, how does that work?
So you can't. Oh, yeah, so
this is Rebecca.
Hi, everybody. Nice to be on here with Ted and Sarah. I think I want to clarify one point, which is that so the net zero stretch code is included in this iteration of the climate bill that is being sent to the governor's desk. I know there's been a lot of back and forth. So the governor in the past has moved to strip this language out. The legislature, thankfully, came out really strong and said we need to include a stretch code that might have the capacity to apply to retrofits as well as new buildings. The details of it are not in the climate bill; they're to be hammered out. Okay. But yeah, so for instance, the Energy Zero or EZ code that MCAN was involved in the development of directs buildings, large commercial buildings, to purchase RECs that are mass class one RECs. So that means that energy that the building is purchasing to offset its carbon pollution would also be contributing to local clean energy on the grid. And building codes can be really specific in what kinds of partnerships building owners are and aren't allowed to engage in.
Really, really. So it constrains future actions by the different people that own the building, right? They have to maintain buying those if for whatever reason they need to buy the RECs in order to get the building to net zero energy usage, right?
This is true. But I should also lift up that this is mainly for really large commercial and industrial buildings. So residential buildings, for the most part, are able to offset all of the carbon that they produce by solar and by having a really low, having really tight efficiency and a low heating and cooling load.
Well, tell me if this is now getting in sort of into the weeds. If I build a house according to the net zero building code, right? I don't have any natural gas coming into the house. Everything is electrified. What carbon dioxide is the house producing?
None.
All right. So that's the magic, right? I mean, it's for a house. The net zero is being totally electrified and being tight, right?
In some definitions of a net zero code. I think this is kind of the wonky thing. So the legislation says DOER shall write and promulgate a net zero code within 18 months of the bill's passage. I think we should expect that we'll have to really continue our advocacy to the Baker administration and to DOER to make sure that we have the most stringent definition of net zero possible. Like Sarah alluded to, there are certainly definitions that leave out some of the three prongs of efficiency, electrification, and renewables. So codes that focus only on renewables and leave out two other pieces of the puzzle. So we want to make sure that we're advocating for a really holistic building code that would actually be producing zero emissions for new construction.
So there's plenty of work to be done, you're saying, is that we have now made a commitment to this net zero building code, and we have really good ideas, but now we need to continue to make sure that those ideas are incorporated over the next 18 months, right?
This is true. Yeah. So we have direction. I mean, this is the bill that MCAN filed back in 2018 that said we want the state to develop a net zero building code, and we're not code experts, so we're not going to tell you how to write it. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, 2.5 years later, we thankfully have a lot more expertise and more specifics on what we want to advocate for. So we're ready to, right. Sarah and my successor are ready, I think, to engage our advocacy community in this process with DOER to make sure that we're advocating for the strongest code.
And there's a mandated, I mean, it's not like you're fighting about, we're pushing for the possibility of such a thing. Now it's deemed that we will have one, right? We're talking about what's the content of that. That's what has probably changed with the next generation climate bill, right?
This is true. Yeah. So I do want to lift up though that there are members of our opposition, we can say industry groups, that I think we should expect to try and water down this language. So right. even though the language is pretty unambiguous in the climate bill, it says DOER shall write a building code that addresses net zero building standards that municipalities can opt into. I think we should still expect certain opponents to right. try and wriggle out of that commitment.
Right.
And I think it's really important, you know, for folks listening to the podcast to really pay attention to the language that comes out of DOER over the next year and a half. And so anything that sounds like a high performance energy code, once again, you know, if it doesn't have all three elements of a net zero building or net zero standards, then it's not a net zero code that's being developed.
Right. Right.
And so I think that's really important. And we had somebody ask Rebecca and I, you know, what is the difference between high performance energy code and a net zero code? Is it just semantics? No, not at all. They are very, very different kinds of buildings. One can be super, they're both super efficient, but only one, and that's the net zero building, is the one that is full of clean energy and good, healthy indoor air.
So I mean, the high-performance building is basically, let me say it, the high-performance building would be airtight, so to speak, but would be running on natural gas, and that's the
correct.
Problem. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, and the last thing we want is to build really tight buildings that we're then pumping full of gas.
Yes.
That just makes no sense and seems to be pretty evidently an attempt to continue to lay down gas pipelines and build gas infrastructure.
Yeah. So the way I hear it is that the next generation climate roadmap bill, next generation climate roadmap bill has strong environmental justice language, and it has a commitment to a net zero building code, and that both of those play into MCAN's mission in life, and that the task over the next 18 months is to make sure and certain that the net zero building code is a true net zero building code and not a, how shall I say, sheep and wolf's clothing. I don't think that's right. A wolf in sheep's clothing sneaking in to try and water down the good and noble intent of the net zero code, right? Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement. What we don't want are solar installations on top of gas-powered buildings.
Got it.
In the sense, you know, because you don't potentially have the efficiency there.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many different ways to use just one or two parts of the three parts to a net zero building. And we really want folks to focus on making sure whatever comes out of DOER, and as we mobilize our advocates and folks across different industries from design, construction, and workforce development, that we really are thinking along those three lines: renewables, electrification, and efficiency.
So, I mean, the future's hard to see, as they say. But I mean, from MCAN's perspective, when you say mobilizing our advocates, we're talking about people, MCAN members, right, that can testify, learn about what's going on in their own towns. I mean, this will probably be a battle that is somewhat fought out at the town level, right? What do you see the MCAN organization doing?
This is a great question, and this is something Rebecca and I have talked about. And, you know, MCAN is a bridge. We provide resources and training. We connect local advocates to working on projects across the state. And we actually bring local advocates together to learn from each other. So over the next 18 months, we're going to be convening a lot of Zoom calls on what is a net zero building? What is a net zero stretch code? How can different advocacy groups across the state partner with MCAN to really make it clear to DOER and to the Board of Building Standards and Regulations that we want a certain kind of net zero stretch code, one that has all three piers to the foundation. And so this is going to be a lot of outreach. I do want to emphasize, you know, we MCAN is working with community groups that are not necessarily MCAN chapters. We really are very interested in supporting local volunteers, local activists, regardless of, you know, their official affiliation with MCAN on these issues. That's really important because, you know, this is an all hands on deck situation. We are right at the cusp of really transforming the building industry here in the Commonwealth. And it will serve as a model for the rest of New England and in many ways the rest of the state. Because what we want to demonstrate is that we're already building to net zero. We're already doing this. We're already doing this with healthcare facilities, affordable housing projects. And our partner organization, Built Environment Plus, has created a project database demonstrating that right now, net zero buildings have been built with less than 1% of their construction costs being tied to net zero standard. So we already know how to do this. We know how to fix our buildings and make them healthy and part of the climate solution. And so what MCAN is really interested in doing over the next 18 months is making sure that advocates from across the state have a voice in making sure this code is a truly net zero code, and making and working with our affordable housing developer partners as well, and also working with our partner organizations that are seeking funding to put more money into workforce development programs, because we need laborers to help us scale up the volume, right? We need laborers to actually know, okay, I know how to put in an air source heat pump and I know how to maintain it and install it over, you know, going into the future. So we're taking an ecosystem-wide approach to this net zero building code situation. We want to make sure that we have a diversity of voices that are all from across the state calling for a true net zero code, and that we do it with a larger picture in mind that we're creating pathways for a just transition.
Excellent. Well, I think that's a what I would like to do. So what we'll put up some links to some of the stuff here. I'd like to invite you two guys to come back and talk more about the question of the retrofittable aspect of this, because there are so many. You guys correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me if you're not an advocate of a building of a net zero building code now, you don't know, you've never heard of it before. The stakes are that this is the most clear-cut path to a climate solution. That's why you should be caring, right? It's the just, effective, future-oriented. It's the right way to go for climate action at the local level, right? If you can't, you know, put a wind turbine in your backyard, right? The thing to do is to push forward on this front. Rebecca, would you agree that that's true?
I would, yeah. So I would say, first of all, that like the reason we're able to have this conversation now is because of local climate advocates and because towns and cities across the Commonwealth have risen up and been very vocal to both the Baker administration, his Board of Building Regulations and Standards, and to the legislature that we can't wait any longer. We need to be able to require net zero for new construction now. And I think the advantage of getting involved in our campaign work is that we can work to create system-wide change. So we're not just looking at giving people that can afford it the tools to essentially buy their way into a net zero lifestyle. What we're looking is to create, like you said, Ted, efficient, effective, inclusive, and transformative policy structures that all towns and cities can access.
Let me say that if you have a question about the podcast, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. But Sarah, let me put you on the spot. What's the email for MCAN if someone wants to write in and say, I need to sign up for this? Is information@massclimateaction?
Oh, please just email me directly. Okay. It may take me a day to get back in touch with you, but I will. And my email is my first name, Sarah, with an H, @massclimateaction.net.
Super, super. If you're listening to this on your this podcast on your smartphone, please tell all of your friends to listen to us on their smartphones. You can find us on all of the modern podcast distribution apps. We want to thank our friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of that, we have to insist the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Rebecca, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
Sarah, thank you for taking the time to chat.
Of course, Ted. Happy to be here.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.